This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Welcome to the Wheeler Centre. My name's Tony Birch from Mundani Bellick Academic Centre at Victoria University, but I'm here tonight on behalf of both the Wheeler Centre and the Yirrumbol Festival, which is going on here at the Wheeler Centre this week and, of course, all around town. And that is a festival sponsored by and organised by the City of Melbourne, with the Wheeler Centre as one of the great partners of the festival. Of course, we want to start tonight by an acknowledgement of country, and the country we're on tonight is Wurundjeri country. We also want to, of course, acknowledge the Bunurong people and, of course, the members of the Greater Kulin Nation of what people may know as the Port Phillip District. We want to pay respect to all Kulin people. We want to pay respect to ancestors, and we want to pay respect to elders present. In doing so, though, of course, we also want to pay respect to you as an audience for being here. Thank you very much. And we also want to extend our respect to your communities and to your elders, and that we hope this is part of a conversation which is about us finding ways to connect and work cooperatively around issues of ecology, environment, and certainly climate change. We have three remarkable guests tonight. They have long bios, but we're only going to do the short one. Sitting next to me is Karina Nolan. Karina is a Yorta Yorta woman. She's done a lot of work in activism and certainly in issues of environmental rights and Indigenous rights. She also works extensively with SEED, SEED being the Young Indigenous Activist and Environmental Group that we'll talk about tonight. And one of her primary goals is to build power and engagement with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities in an effort to make change around certainly Aboriginal rights and rights around country and issues such as environmental protection, amongst other things that Karina does. Karina is not filling in for Amelia Telford, but Amelia Telford was to be here tonight, but she can't make it. And we're very fortunate that Karina can make it and will get a really strong perspective on what she and SEED are doing through her engagement tonight. We also have sitting next to Karina, John Altman. John Altman is a research professor at the Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalisation at Deakin University and an emeritus professor at the Australian National University. And it says here that John is one of Australia's most engaged public intellectuals, and he also frequently writes for a broad audience on Aboriginal economic issues in Inside Story, Crikey, Arena and New Matilda. John is also a wonderful person. John and I had the maybe the sad duty of packing up the library of a great friend of ours, Patrick Wolfe, a wonderful scholar who died, unfortunately, about 18 months ago now. And in that morning that John and I spent up at Patrick's house at Healesville, I got to know him in a way that I hadn't before, including the fact that he's not as strong as he looks physically. But we had wonderful conversations about many of the issues that interest us.
26th January, was it, Tony?
Yes, it was 26th of January, which is Invasion Day and my grandmother's birthday. Okay, and sitting next to John is Eve Vincent. And it says here that Eve Vincent is a lecturer in the Department of Anthropology at Macquarie University. She's a co-editor with Timothy Neal of Unstable Relations. Someone want to hold a copy of the book up? I left mine out the back. Unstable Relations, Indigenous People and Environmentalism in Contemporary Australia, which is what we're here to talk about tonight. And again, just a little bit of extras about Eve. I've known her for many, many years, and I taught her on one occasion about 20 years ago, and therefore it's not surprising that she has made it to the stage tonight. The other issue, just before I go on, is that to note that, of course, the book that we're not holding in our hands up here is available at the back, and Hill of Content, our bookseller tonight, will be happy to sell you copies of this remarkable and important book. So to get started formally, I do want to start with Eve, and as I said, she co-edited the book with Timothy Neal, who I think will probably be here tonight as well. What I'd like to begin with, Eve, is if you could tell us what motivated Tim and you to bring this book together. I know there was a conference you initiated or a gathering before the book was developed. What was the idea of bringing a group of people together on this issue?
Yeah, so Tim and I had been working on this for a few years before we gathered together the contributors in the book. What we were trying to do is to pick up a number of stories, I guess, or arguments that get made about the meeting of green-black interests and environmentalists and Indigenous people in Australia today, and to push those arguments, to take up those arguments, to complicate them, to probe them. So there's a whole series of arguments that I do think circulate publicly now. One of them is, in the past, we might have assumed an affinity between environmentalists and Aboriginal people, but I think increasingly over recent years, there's been a public argument that assumes that these interests are counterposed, that Indigenous positions and environmentalist positions are necessarily, inevitably in conflict. We wanted to take up this idea of inevitable affinity or inevitable conflict and to really complicate that and get up close to a range of scenarios and see how best to characterise this relationship in much more nuanced terms. We really wanted to take up this argument that circulates now. It's quite common and pernicious, I think, the idea that where Aboriginal people are standing, say, in opposition to a mine, they are probably being manipulated, that they are somehow passive, that greenies are writing the script, that they're animating these Aboriginal spokespeople and somehow they're behind the scenes. So this assumption of Aboriginal passivity seemed to us quite untenable. And we wanted to find out, in all these different scenarios, how these relationships had come about, so how they came into being. We were interested in, I guess, the argument about wilderness discourse, the critique of the way environmentalists perpetuate images of a pristine and untouched land. We think this is a really important argument, but we're also aware that critique has been made now since the mid-1990s. So we wanted to know whether or not it's still a valid critique. So it is obviously concerning, this idea that environmentalists might perpetuate an idea of an idea akin to terra nullius, an image of wilderness. But we were interested in whether or not since the mid-1990s the environment movement has changed, has absorbed that critique in some way, has looked for different kinds of images and terms. I could go on and on. I'll say one last argument that we think circulates that we wanted to kind of fill out, characterise, get closer to, and that was we wanted to question these very terms of black-green, these sort of categories that suggest there are two and only two kinds of people in these scenarios. So we wanted to see just how varied Indigenous politics and positions are in these spaces, and also to look at the ways in which environmentalists often indigenise themselves in these scenes, the way in which it might be best to talk about Aboriginal greenies, not Aboriginal people and greenies. So we found ourselves quite dependent on those terms and we kept returning to them, but at the same time we wanted to get away from them and look at entanglements, engagements, the interpenetration of green and black.
Thank you. And before I go on, I was amiss before, our wonderful Daniel Hatley is doing all the hard yards tonight, so please make Daniel feel welcome. The other thing, I know in relationship to your own work, your PhD is in anthropology and you'd worked what we might call field work, but certainly working on the ground with Aboriginal communities. Mm-hmm. How did that impact on your own, I suppose, your growth and thinking prior to that engagement, and how has that thinking influenced where you're at now?
Yeah, sure. So I do have a very personal connection to this topic. I have a background as a greenie, those years in Melbourne where I studied under Tony Birch, and was very involved with the Jabiluka Action Group, and later I was very involved with a really inspiring campaign against a proposed nuclear waste dump in the north of South Australia. So I worked as part of a small group in Melbourne called the Melbourne Kungas in support of the Kupapiti Kunga Juta, some wonderful old ladies, many of whom have passed away now. So I was interested when I did turn to anthropology, and the reason in the book we turn to anthropology is it gets up so close, and it can potentially give us so much complexity and so much humanity into these sorts of, you know, it can sketch these political questions in very human terms. I turned to anthropology in order to get up close to greenies and to inquire into the terms of these relationships, because certain aspects of the relationship had come to trouble me. And in this scenario, I then went and studied, and which I write about in the book, I do have some questions about the kinds of investments in particular models of Aboriginality that I think environmentalists bring to this scenario. So it's a scenario out in far west South Australia, this, you know, fantastic group of Gugudda people who have really reinvigorated a traditional practice of caring for rock hole sites on their country. And their efforts to tend to those rock holes have heightened importance because of how much mineral exploration is going on their country. And they have enlisted, they have very much drawn the resources of the environment movement to them. So there's a sort of handful of greenies that go out with them onto country. And I was interested in the dynamic, I guess, and I was interested in, you know, what happens when environmentalists go out there and they you know, bring so much with them. They bring their hope for a particular kind of version of this, you know, indigenous cultural person who is you're culturally different in very specific ways and can turn out to be actually living a life that's shared with lots of local white fellas and to be culturally different in ways that are more surprising and that also involve class very strongly, and that the form their difference takes can disappoint greenies. I was also interested in the way greenies, and certainly me, bring with them into that scenario what we might call a sort of post-colonial angst or anxiety. So much respect, so much, you know, sense of complicity in the history of colonisation, so much of a burden of a sense of one's own privilege, that actually bringing all that to the scenario can inhibit the very thing greenies are seeking, which is a connection, which is some kind of possibility of relating to, getting to know and being with Aboriginal people. But actually bringing all that can create distance.
Thank you very much. Now, John, and following your work very closely and reading a lot of it recently, and certainly recent years, your experience is somewhat different in the sense that you've been working, I think, certainly with the same group of people and often with the same friends now for many decades. Mm. So you first went to the Territory in the 70s. So how have you seen that relationship shift in regard to some of these issues around environmentalism from when you started as a younger researcher to where you are now?
Yeah, thanks, Tony. I went to Western Arnhem Land in 1979, and I went up as a rather naive economist who was told that to understand Aboriginal economy, I'd better become an anthropologist and understand the cultural dimension of economy. And I coincidentally did that by going to live with a group of Ginningu-speaking people in Western Arnhem Land who had land rights and had a very dire, structurally violent colonial experience at a government settlement, and had gone back to live on their land and to go back to live off their land. So land rights law gave them land rights and it also gave them resource rights. And what they did was they didn't go back to some pristine hunter-gatherer way of living. What they did was they refigured their relations with global capitalism and the Australian state, and also they rekindled very strong elements of their custom to sort of live a plural, or what I term a hybrid economy, that combined customary production through hunting and fishing and gathering, production of art for sale, and getting some services from the Australian state. But they, in a way, reinvented for themselves a way of living off the land, and that included the sustainable use of wildlife, and it also included managing the landscape with fire. Now, I didn't see this, even though I was now transforming into an economic anthropologist, as these Guningu people being conservationists, and nor did they. Mm-hmm. And I guess the interesting transformation I've seen is that their land has now been, in a sense, surrendered or put into the Australian Conservation Estate as an Indigenous protected area. And this is a massive area. You know, I work with two Indigenous protected areas in Western Arnhem Land that cover 20,000 square kilometres, the same size as Kakadu. Mm. And these areas have been declared Indigenous protected areas because of their conservation and cultural values. So these people who were, I termed them hunter-gatherers today, suddenly also had to become involved in being conservationists today. And this transformation is something they did by altering, if you like, their relationship with the Australian state, by taking on the role of being community-based rangers. Now, the Australian state pays some people to be rangers, but the vast majority of people who manage the landscape in Western Arnhem Land do so as Guningu people struggling to live off the land. And I emphasise struggling because in the last decade or so, I've seen another transformation, which is out of this sort of economic hybridity that was working to people. In fact, the Australian state, post-intervention, looking to get people back off the land and centralise them back in the township, so drive them off the land, while at the same time also, somewhat duplicitously, I think, wanting to see an Indigenous protected area being managed for its biodiversity values, which are unbelievable, and its cultural values, which again are quite unique in terms of the rock art galleries and other values that are embedded in that landscape. So I've seen a series of transformations, and I think, at the moment, I'm quite despondent because I can see people in the West Arnhem region looking to live on the land, looking to undertake, projects of benefit, not just to themselves, but to the nation and to the world, particularly through the carbon abatement work they do, which is reducing carbon emissions, which is assisting globally with climate change. Some of this work is being supported by the Australian state. Some of this work is being supported by a multinational corporation. But the bottom line is that this work is under-recognised, under-remunerated, and people, are struggling in 2017, and I was in Arnhem Land just 2 weeks ago, are struggling more in 2017 to live off their land, to enjoy their land rights and resource rights, that they're struggling more now than they were in 1979 when I was first with them. And to me, this is quite a devastating turn of events, because in that intervening period when we had policies around self-determination, we actually had people making a very comfortable living for themselves. It was never easy, but people were able to provision themselves. And now we see people, on basics cards. We see people being breached and losing welfare income. And we actually see people in rich Australia, in a resource-rich part of the country, going hungry, and not being able to get a feed.
The other issue, I mean, talk about the institutionalisation of daily life through the intervention. I mean, the what else has happened, and you could certainly tease it out for me, is that you have this notion, so you're talking about people originally having gone back to country with genuine land rights, then you get a sort of a centralised or bureaucratised system. That shift from, you know, there is a caring for country scheme, and I know that there was a dynamic where they even changed that to working for country. Mm-hmm. It seems to be now that the way that mob are seen up there is that they've been put almost into an institutional setting of which is driven by accountancy or something. Mm. That's the language, at least. So how has that changed in the way of that? You said state, you know, the Australian state. Mm. That's another form of intervention, which the state would probably posit as something affirmative, but it seems to be that it's not affirmative at all.
Yeah, well, I think that the Working on Country program and you know, many environmentalists and activists fought hard for this program, now does deliver, you know, certain employment levels for Aboriginal people who work as rangers. But the bottom line is that there's 880 of these rangers being paid to manage 2 million square kilometres of Australia, you know, a massive area. Mm. And when you localise that down to a place like Western Arnhem Land, where you have two Indigenous protected areas, you know, what people have to struggle against is this attempt to neoliberalise, you know, their work arrangements and to hold them accountable very much in statistical and Western ways. But interestingly enough, you know, these places are still remote, and the regulators, you know, sit in Canberra. They're not on country. So people refigure their work relationships and they refigure their work routines, you know. And so in the Manangreta region, the Jelk Rangers might have 30 ranger positions to manage 10,000 square kilometres, but they break those up into 60 part-time positions and people come and go. And again, that institution of sharing, you know, that the Australian state is hell-bent on breaking, you know, mm-hmm. to individualise people and to make them all accumulate, you know, utilising mainstream Australian norms and values. People resist that. You know, the rangers go out and they shoot buffalo and they deliver meat to family.
Yeah.
You know, they find ways to refigure these neoliberal arrangements to suit their purposes, but it's never easy. It's always a struggle, and it's a struggle that is unnecessary because really the work they do is so valuable that they should be recognised and rewarded, not potentially, you know, under-resourced and punished if they don't conform to mainstream ways.
Yeah, thank you, John. Now, Karina Nolan, one of the things, if you could just, as a start, you work with SEED, and you certainly do work yourself as a facilitator and educator, which I'll ask you in a moment. But just broadly in relationship to SEED, for people who don't know SEED, could you give the audience an insight into, you know, what SEED is, what it does, what its objectives have been, and maybe some of its approaches to these issues?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So SEED is Australia's first Indigenous Youth Climate Network, and it does work with AYCC, which is Australian Youth Climate Coalition, and it's been going for a couple of years, and really I guess the philosophy there is that, you know, our young people, over half of our Indigenous population is under 35, so we have a hugely young population. Unfortunately, the other stat that goes with that is that we're 28 times more likely our young people to be in the criminal justice system, and I don't know if folks are aware, but we're actually currently imprisoned at the highest rate of any people anywhere in the world, which is an appalling statistic. So one of the things that SEED is about is, you know, obviously we're dealing with climate change, which is an enormous crisis which impacts every one of us in this room, but it impacts Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people disproportionately. We're about skilling our young mob to, you know, be able to deal with the problems, and actually often our communities have the solutions and just need more capacity actually to make those solutions a reality. So a lot of the philosophy really is about building people up, bringing people together to talk about, you know, the nitty-gritty, the ins and outs of climate change. And we've actually been talking about that as protecting country, because actually we are the world's oldest environmentalists, and we've been protecting country for thousands and thousands of generations, and it's our right and responsibility to do that. So we don't need to talk to people about climate change in some ways, you know, because we know what's happening in our communities, and we know what's happening on country. We know that the seasons are changing, and, you know, the old people tell us that you can't go and catch fish at the same time because the wattle might have been changing colour. You know, it's meant to happen in a certain sequence, and those sequences are now out of whack. So in some ways, that's not the piece that needs to happen with our people. It's not about the kind of education around, you know, the kind of climate crisis. It's actually supporting people to deal with the impacts on country, and so we're focusing as SEED on young people.
I mean, it's interesting you say that thing about, you know, about not being environmentalists. One of the things that I noticed in one of the interviews in the book and in the research I'm doing, which is fairly obvious, is that, you know, when, you know, most Aboriginal people who are working to protect country will say, well, we're not environmentalists, not in a sort of negative way, we're just doing what we do, we're doing our stuff. And even that terrible statistic you give about young people in prisons, it's really interesting that one of the things that I it's almost like a naive realization is that how you have to explain often to non-Aboriginal people the value of place and country, because even young blackfellas who have been incarcerated, even young blackfellas who haven't had formal education, if you talk to them and you say, well, yeah, country's important, they understand that inherently. Mm. It's not an education as in a sort of formal education. They understand it through culture and experience. The other thing I'm interested in, and it goes to the sort of, you know, the, I suppose in a way, the cliche of the black-green conflict or opposition, not that it's not real, and I'll turn to that in a moment, but we bumped into each other in the street some time ago out the front of where I live. And you said, what are you doing here? And I said, what are you doing here? I said, I live here. And you said, I'm staying here. That morning you were going down to Ceres, which people probably know in Brunswick, which Ceres is a, you know, some people regard as an urban farm, but an educational facility around sustainability, environmental issues, et cetera. You were going to run a workshop, and I think from memory in that conversation, that was a workshop that you were running for non-Aboriginal people, environmentalists, activists, et cetera. Could you just tell us what that role is, what you're hoping to achieve through that, and what sort of people you're engaging with who we might see as part of this opposition, again, in a sort of shallow way?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's really a small piece of my work in some ways, because I've been trying to focus, because I think the gap really is on our mob. You know, there's a lot of, I think, non-Indigenous folks in the movement have a lot of resources at their disposal, and I sometimes feel like we actually need to be turning our attention to be building our own people. So that's where I spend the bulk of my time. But you're right, that particular workshop was actually about climate justice. And one of the things that we're really seeing is that people seem to be able to separate out environment from country and, you know, talk about protecting or stopping a coal mine because people want to see climate change constrained, and we know that we're in a tipping point and, you know, dangerous global warming, etc. So people are kind of interested in stopping coal, which is absolutely right, but what we're also talking about is what's the community development project and what's the kind of land rights and land justice that underpins what happens for communities once that coal project is stopped. You know, it's the broader kind of ongoing work that I think we need to talk about, and it's the justice part, isn't it? Because, you know, it's unequally impacting on our people, so we're kind of trying to bring that.
I mean, that's that interesting. A Canadian Indigenous intellectual and writer I've been reading, Leanne Simpson, she talks about cherry picking, and I think that's the very point where environmentalists and activists come into Indigenous communities and they take little bits from the tree of knowledge that they want and they disregard the rest, and it's the very point you're talking about. That leads me into, if you could possibly give the audience just a little bit of a sense of one of your SEED mob, Larissa Baldwin, put this on Facebook this morning, so I sent it in and asked that it be used as a nice backdrop tonight. Could you just tell us a little bit specifically about what's happening here and what that broader notion of that statement of land rights, not mining rights, how that works?
So people might know that this happened last night in Canberra, so big shout out to all the SEED mob and all the others who made that happen. I think one of the things that's happening, and I think, John, you've written about this a lot, is that our people are constantly having to choose between protecting country and having economic development, and that economic development might only be mining. And so many communities have been promised jobs and you know, employment and other things as a result of signing up for mining deals, and actually haven't ever seen those promises come true. We are not seeing people, you know, poverty alleviated in places where people live next to mines or are part of a mining agreement. So I guess just kind of in terms of the context, that's really the reality. And so at the moment, Native Title is, Brandis has proposed an amendment to it that hasn't been consulted broadly enough with the community. So we're hearing from lots of the remote places that we work that people don't know what's going on. And so last night we felt like it was an important moment to send a message to politicians in Canberra that they can't make a change as big as this, which essentially could extinguish native title for those who haven't received it yet forever, that they can't do that without talking to our mob first.
Eve, back to the book, or not only the motivation behind the book, but certainly reading the book and all the essays, and I think I've said this to Eve, I've been working in this area, like specifically in this area, for only 2 years, and I find myself in some ways, as a researcher, not as a mob, but as a researcher coming from a fairly naive position, reading the book, you do highlight the incredible complexities of the history of the relationships between Aboriginal communities and environmental groups. But that simple opposition of black-green, and you know, you mentioned it earlier, the scenario of, you know, basically Aboriginal people being deceived by greenies, etc. Why is that maintained, or to whose advantage has that, which I would now call a myth, to whose advantage does that myth hold value?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important question. So in lots of the scenarios, so when we inquired into the terms of this relationship, so taking this as a provocation, this idea that it's always environmentalists that take up Indigenous people and who are sort of manipulating Indigenous people, when we did inquire into that, we found actually a lot of... in a lot of different ways, Indigenous people always kind of forging or starting, initiating, seeking out those relationships in order to draw relationships to them, draw resources to them. And so there is a degree of instrumentalism there, and there is also a degree of instrumentalism on the part of environmentalists. So people are getting used, but much more is also happening. So that's what we found. In terms of to what end is this kind of myth and this suspicion sustained, and why does it continue to circulate? I guess it makes any sort of Indigenous opposition to mining, it delegitimises Indigenous opposition to mining. So it supports, I guess, the current and you know, going back to what John's saying, a current kind of ideological trend that says there is no alternative to incorporation into the neoliberal economy and interstate structures, where Indigenous groups articulate a dissatisfaction with that vision, then they're not really articulating that. They couldn't possibly be. It's environmentalists who are just putting them up to it, I guess. And then in a broader and more historical sense, I think there is just a bigger problem in Australia with accepting Indigenous people as legitimate political actors. So I think there's a much longer history of, you know, other forms of Indigenous politics being met with some kind of suspicion on the part of the public, that the commies put them up to it, that there are always somehow, white figures behind the scenes, and the Indigenous people were not giving voice to their own politics, desires, aspirations, which is just a kind of deeper colonial image of Indigenous people as easily manipulated and as not fully kind of formed political subjects.
I mean, it's interesting because, John, it would seem to me that taking up Eve's point while she was talking, it's... if I could use the term, it's particular Indigenous actors that shouldn't seem to be political, because there's almost a sense that the groups who live in remote parts, so-called remote parts of Australia or around mining in regional areas, that they're more pristine but at the same time naive. Mm. So no one would say that Gary Foley's not a legitimate political actor or Marcia Langton's not a legitimate political actor. But these people, of course, in their innocence are being manipulated. Mm. Now, you might want to throw this into this question, because the other thing that's relative there that interests me is that this might seem, again, a naive proposition, but imagine that I'm coming to an economist slash anthropologist. One of the things, a conclusion I reached in the most recent essay that I published, is it goes to your point about the carbon scheme that you talked about earlier, is that what Aboriginal people are doing on country is not only for the benefit of themselves, if they're left to do it effectively, they are now really part of, you know, this is a global issue. Carbon emissions being a global issue. Mm. So what happens in Australia and what happens, whether it be an Adani mine or a carbon scheme that you're talking about, it impacts either positively or negatively on the whole planet, is that if Aboriginal people on their own country where they have legitimate land rights are engaged in schemes that are easing the stress of carbon, why can't we come up with some sort of economic scheme that says, well, this has an economic benefit and these people... It's not compensation. They actually should be economically rewarded or gained by the fact that they're doing something which is going to be of economic benefit to the planet. Mm. Now, I know that might be a naive suggestion, but why can't that... Is that sort of scheme being put forward?
Yeah, well, I think it does happen at the moment, you know, through the Tony Abbott's famous Emissions Reduction Fund, where, you know, the Australian taxpayers do pay rangers a pittance for... reducing carbon emissions. But what they're paid, you know, interestingly, in my view, is quite unsustainable, and it has to be cross-subsidised by other things that the rangers do under the Working on Country program or under contracts to government departments. So what they actually get paid through the silent auction system is far less than the cost and the effort that goes into reducing the carbon emissions. But make no mistake, you know, across nearly 70,000 square kilometres of Arnhem Land, Indigenous ranger groups, you know, in the last calendar year, reduced carbon emissions by over 800,000 tonnes. You know, so they are making an extraordinary contribution in the tropical savannah, and they should be properly remunerated for that, and the contracts, you know, again, it's surprising that the contracts they have under the Emissions Reduction Fund only, you know, some, we're not allowed to know what the per ton rate is, but it's somewhere around $10 to $12 a ton. You know, those are on forward contracts of 10 years, which of course carries a risk for the groups because the value of carbon might go up quite dramatically in the next few years. The point that I wanted to go back to, though, in terms of where we're at with mining and Indigenous people, is that in the 1970s, in 1976, you know, last year we celebrated 40 years of land rights in the Territory, and 40 years ago the Australian government passed law that gave Aboriginal traditional owners free prime form consent rights in terms of what happens on their land. And you're right, Tony, that those fancy terms, free prime form consent rights, don't mean much to people who mightn't even speak English, but they, again, historically have had strong Indigenous representative organisations that have represented their rights and have delivered them a form of social justice. And what we've subsequently seen with native title laws is a far more diluted right in relation to excluding activity from the land that Aboriginal people don't want, that traditional owners don't want. And yet at the same time, I think, you know, the aspirations of people who want to make a living off the land, who want to manage the land in a way that maintains its environmental values, you know, these people are natural allies with conservationists. Where else does one turn? Do you turn to the Conservatives? Do you turn to the ALP? I mean, you know, the dominant Australian state represents a broker or corporate state. It always aligns with multinational corporations. So what are the natural allies for Indigenous people who don't want mining on their land? And those natural allies are conservationists. And what we've seen is some extraordinary wins for that coalition, you know, at Coronation Hill, at Jabiluka, at James Price Point, hopefully at Adani. You know, these are natural allies who politically, you know, still represent minority, you know, very much a minority interest in Australia, but nevertheless, you know, they're finding voice and they're forming social movements that are proving quite effective in stopping thoughtless development that is, you know, not in the national or global interest.
Thank you, John. Karina, I remember there was a series of global climate change marches in 2015, and there was one held here in Melbourne, and I took a lot of photographs at that rally, and Seed Mob were the lead float. It was like a sort of activist Moomba parade, and Seed were right up front. And I remember thinking on that day is that the message that Seed were very vocal about was that it's a similar to the slide behind us, is that certainly Seed and yourself are a group interested in these very things that John's talking about the real difficulty that we're facing in regard to climate change, the real issues around environmental and ecological protection. But the other two things that came out very strongly on that day was that the discussion of sovereignty and, of course, that the discussion of climate change or environmental protection must be clearly and formally linked to land rights protection. Mm. So I've got a two-part question for you. One is that how do you and how does a group like Seed negotiate relationships which, and I don't mean this cynically, but, yeah, we'll put Seed at the front. It looks great. The flag's there. How do you negotiate that strategically, knowing that? And secondly, how do you find your strategic relationship to environmental groups when you want to make sure that that message of land rights, sovereignty and environmental protection have equal value?
Mm-hmm. It's complicated.
But I'll give you 4 minutes.
Yeah, great. I think one of the tensions is I agree, there's a lot of synergies and a lot of work that can be done together, but I think sometimes our paths do diverge, right, which is partly around the sovereignty and the land rights. It's like I think sometimes environmentalists might see a win that's like we stopped this particular development, we stopped this particular mine, we stopped fracking going ahead, but that doesn't mean that people then have achieved their native title or achieved land justice or achieved any of the other things that we might have aspirations for in our community. And at that point, do the paths diverge? Often. And I think sometimes we're left wondering, well, are you just kind of using us to achieve your ends, right? So part of our job is also to negotiate and make sure that we're using allies like others are using us as well sometimes to kind of boost the power of our campaign, to learn new skills, to kind of, take on some of that, the other allies that environmentalists often have. I mean, the thing about Vincent Lingari and that entire campaign was that it was the unions were supporting folks, but they became the messengers, and non-Indigenous Australians were happy to listen to the union movement more than they were happy to listen to blackfellas at that point in time. So, it's strategic for us to work those allies as well. And I think, the climate march was definitely a bit of that. People were like, oh, it'll look bad if we don't have blackfellas up the front and we don't do that, right? I think people genuinely were like the visual of it, but also there were some people who really deeply got it that we need to, if we want to see an end to the climate crisis, and it presents with crisis comes opportunity, right? We know that we need to rebuild a system that doesn't have inequality at its heart, and who better to do that than people who've been, living on this country for 60,000 years and who've been innovating for that amount of time. We need to draw on the knowledge of, First Nations people to rebuild that system. So I think, the less cynical part of us was like, we need to work with all of those people if we want to rebuild something different. So I think it's different, it depends. And, like us, we're not a one people. Like the environment movement, there's not one part of the movement. People have different skills and capacities and different experiences like folks in this room. So we also can't treat the movement as one homogenous beast either. It's not helpful for us to do it that way.
Okay, we're going to take questions very shortly, so if our mic people could come up. Just while you're getting your questions, and if you've already got one, please stick your hand up. Just with regard to the questions, I'd certainly hope that I really want the questions to be relatively concise and to the point so that we can get through as many responses as possible. And I suppose just while you're getting your questions together, I do want to say that in regard to particularly Eve's last comment and Karina's, is that I think one of the realities here, and again, I think certainly with John's experience in the Territory, I don't, when I talk about that, the potential problems that exist with those relationships. I don't say that in any cynical way. I think what Eve's alluding to is that that's the way the political strategies operate, that there are times when your common interest will be really important to bring people together in a common campaign, and then there are other times when it will diverge, and I think it can diverge naturally and without acrimony. So that I think it shows a sophistication. I mean, what I've witnessed, by the way, as someone being involved in this in recent years, is that a level of sophistication in an organisation which is absolutely vital to tackle issues that we're like something like opposing Adani or certainly the broader issue around climate. So we're ready to take questions. So who's ready to ask one? So I'm not going to point to people because I can't see anything. So the people with the mics, you can make the selections.
Mr. Altman, you said that you rangers in East Arnhem Land saved 800,000 cubic metres of greenhouse gases. How did they do that? Did they plant trees or what did they do?
Yeah, what I said was that a company called Arnhem Land Fire Abatement Northern Territory, which is a coalition of rangers across 70,000 square kilometres of Arnhem Land, have abated 800,000 tonnes of greenhouse gas emissions. And the way they've done that is by using customary knowledge about fire. So basically what they've done is burn the country in the early dry season, as they used to do for millennia, to create patchy burns. And what that does is reduce wildfires in the late dry season. And through remote sensing, one can actually measure the historical gap when the country wasn't managed by rangers with the contemporary situation, where you actually get cool fires in the early dry seasons and you get either fewer fires in the late dry season, or what you do get, which in some ways is almost humorous, is you get indigenous people who actually turn into firefighters in the late dry season, something that they never did pre-colonially, because they're trying to stop hot fires that emit a lot of greenhouse gases. So it's a combination, if you like, of early dry season burning across a wide landscape, using helicopters and incendiaries, using vehicles, and also walking across country, and then putting out fires in the late dry season. But it's really important to understand that this is remotely monitored. It's quite strictly regulated, and the tons measured are in fact quite accurate, because that's in fact what people get paid for in relation to that activity.
I'm particularly worried about the possible Adani mine in Queensland. And Karina, I'm wondering, as an activist, what's your view? Is it going to be possible to stop this mine going ahead?
Well, you know, I'm only going to give one answer to a big group of people like this, aren't I? You know, because of course it can. Yeah, absolutely, I think it can. I think there's a range of people working on it, coming at it from many different angles. I'll put up the website for Wangatajagalingu, which is the traditional owners where the mine is proposed to be built, but there's actually a whole range of other traditional owners also potentially impacted by this. And there's a whole range of environmental groups working on it as well. And there's a lot of ways to hook into the campaign. And, you know, it's about this mine, but it's also about land justice. And it's, I think this is one of those campaigns that we could really show an alliance of kind of, you know, not just environmentalists and Aboriginal people working together, but much broader than that, because actually climate justice is about everyone, and it's about workers in particular. If we, you know, we need to think about ways that the union movement also understand that workers are going to be deeply and are currently impacted by the climate crisis as well. And we need to be looking at jobs that look very different to how they look now. So this is an all-in kind of campaign, but also it's an Indigenous-led one, and I think we need to respect, you know, the traditional owners up there and working with them and alongside them in the best way we can. So I'll put up the link at the end.
Yeah, g'day. Thanks so much for the talk. It was really great, all of you, and big fans of all your work. I'll try and be quick. To what extent would, just a quick thought from everyone on the panel, would you think that environmental rights, land justice, economic justice, self-determination could all be built into the sort of fledgling treaty negotiations that are going ahead in Victoria at the moment, given that they're going to be fundamentally with a quite neoliberal, development-driven government.
What do you reckon, Tony?
Sit down. He's my student. John is going to have a go at it, but just one of the things on that, Massimo, which I haven't talked to you about in supervision meetings. I've talked extensively about this with Gary Murray, and Gary Murray is someone who's very, very heavily involved in the treaty process at a grassroots level. I don't want to take up time on this, but I think one of the things is that there are two ways to think about the treaty, and one is a bit like John's problems or the problems of the territory in a sort of short-term bureaucratic institutional way, which is not going to work effectively for mobs down here, and one which is about taking time to get it right and do it in an effective way. If you take time and get it right in an effective way, you can build into the process of treaty very vital protection of country environmental rights, so that some of the areas that Gary Murray's concerned with that I'm being interested in environmentally is that you would have a much more formal legal say on what's happening on country, country that is now suffering because of the sort of neoliberal policies that are being adopted. So I think, Massimo, quite seriously, it will depend on what sort of treaty document the Victorian State Government is actually interested in producing. And I think at the moment people aren't that optimistic about that document, but if people took a longer view and if people were more patient, it would be possible that you could enter into agreement which had much more formal protection rights around the very issues that you're talking about. But John would know about this for the Northern Territory experience.
Well, I mean, treaties are now being talked about for the Northern Territory, South Australia and Victoria. Treaties are catching on. And to my mind, treaties don't include people's, fundamental economic and environmental rights in relation to their country, then they're not worth, having treaties. I think that this will be, something that will be embedded in treaties. As Tony said, it mightn't be in the first upfront document, but certainly I think treaties will set in place political processes where Indigenous landowners, whether their land's recognised under land rights or native title laws, or whether it's land where they have co-management, will have, I think, important environmental rights in situations where they want them. I think the really important thing to recognise is that there's now 43% of the Australian continent has some form of Indigenous title recognised over it. And when the claims process is completed, those tentacles of native title will be reaching right into states like New South Wales and Victoria. They already are, but you could see up to 70% of the continent under some form of Indigenous title where people have some form of native title right. And those native title rights will be, I think, able to be exercised through treaty instruments, particularly if they focus on environmental issues that are increasingly issues that are shared by a broader Australian public. So why wouldn't you encourage and support Indigenous people who want to manage their lands in a way that's in the national and global interests? I think that it's a no-brainer, and I think eventually, mainstream politics will recognise that no-brainer proposition.
Karina?
I mean, I do agree with that. I got back from... So I spent some time in Turtle Island, both at Standing Rock and also in Canada, and I think what's happening for me is I watched so many people get caught up in the treaty process and they're in courts like we are with native title. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's my hesitation. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I'm still not sure, is that the best we can do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, is that the best we can do? I think historically, in the sense of political activism within Aboriginal communities, it is that often initial gains small gains, and you never expect or hope that it's the best we can do. It's what do we do with that, and how can we value add to it? And sometimes you can, and sometimes you can't. So we don't know the answer to that question. We've got time for one more. So who wants to, right down the back there? There's a big hand going up, a long hand.
Very keen hand.
It's going to take them a while to get down there. So talk amongst yourselves. You're running.
Yes, look, I guess I'm concerned about perhaps more. I've been involved with Aboriginal economic development in Western Australia, and I'm concerned that maybe if we're heading down too much of environmental ways in which there can be economic development, that perhaps we're looking at maybe more traditional ways. And the sorts of things that I'm familiar with is where Aboriginal groups form companies and involve their community and do a lot of work in mining rehabilitation, have heavy machinery work, which they make roads, they do a whole lot of other things in areas which are more traditional employment, but actually is still economic development and it's still associated with the environment. And I'm just wondering if you can comment about how much this has happened elsewhere and whether maybe if we focus too much on looking after land and country, that we're perhaps ignoring real good economic development areas for Aboriginal people, which are both in regional areas and also actually on country.
Mm. John and Karina, I think.
Look, I think you make a good point. And, of course, you know, where there are, you know, regional agreements and Indigenous people, you know, want to engage in providing contract work or taking up jobs in mines, that's an option that should remain open to them. There's no question about that. And so, again, I would emphasise that my notion of, you know, plural economy or economic hybridity doesn't exclude the possibility of engaging in mining work. I think the crucial thing, though, is that the land owners have the right to say whether the mine goes ahead or not. And that is what free prime form consent is. And free prime form consent, you know, which accords with the UN declarations on the rights of Indigenous people, should be everywhere where people have land title in Australia, where Indigenous people have land title. And then they can negotiate the sort of arrangements that they want in terms of the mining of the land or the conservation of the land. The choice should be theirs. And even though, you know, I am conservation inclined, I would feel ethically bound by the decisions that traditional owners make. And if that decision is to engage in mining development, then I would support that decision as long it was free, prior, well-informed consent decision making, and as long as it was something that where there was consensus amongst Indigenous people that they will engage in that sort of activity. So in none of this does it preclude the possibility of engagement in mainstream global capitalism. But I think for the vast majority of people in remote Australia, you know, the prospect of a mine is limited, and when the reality is that when you have mines, you certainly have exceptions where you have enterprise benefits and employment benefits, but it's a small number of people are employed, and sometimes, as Karina said earlier, you get enormous disappointment. We've seen it in Gove, we've seen it in Ranger, we've seen it in many mines in remote Australia, but we also have got some best and good international practice where you do get 10 or 20% of the mine workforce that's Indigenous employees. So that is certainly a possibility. I should have mentioned Ranger. Another disappointment in terms of Indigenous employment. And there's a mine that's going to close. I think what really is important, though, to recognise with Indigenous engagement in mining is what's left behind once the mine closes in terms of opportunity in remote places. And in some ways, the analogy to that is when the conservationists also have a win that's celebrated in terms of having a mine not go ahead. That's great for the conservationists, the non-Indigenous conservationists. They go back to their cosmopolitan living, feeling good about the development not going ahead, but of course it's Aboriginal people who are left behind who still have to make a livelihood off land that's often of limited commercial value, and they have to find ways of making a livelihood under extraordinarily difficult circumstances that I'm sure you've seen in remote Western Australia.
So, Karina, this would be an issue when you're working with communities.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, just a couple of quick things there. I agree the inequity in the process around how people even make those agreements is enormous, the power differential between mining companies coming in. And then, you know, who pays for that to ensure that people are even part of the meetings, you know, and there's no real proper mechanisms. And if communities don't have strong governance, then they're not able to even come together to make, you know, the decisions they want to make anyway. And I mean, I just feel like what other people in this country have to choose between having their basic rights met and a mine sitting on their country. No other people have to do that in this country. And I think just finally on the rehab, you know, I've been working up in the Territory in Borroloola where they're still cleaning up the mess from a copper mine that's 20 years old that has destroyed a whole kind of hunting ground and ceremony area. It's a $20 million clean-up that no one's going to foot the bill for. They've got the world's largest lead and zinc mine, and at the moment what they're saying is they want that mine shut down and they want it cleaned up and they want the rehab jobs for sure. They're very clear about that. But there's not enough money in Glencore's budget. They haven't put aside the amount of money that's required for rehab. I know that that's happening in Kakadu, in a range of places. So mining companies don't necessarily have to put aside the appropriate amount of money for rehab in the first place anyway. So, I mean, I think there's a whole lot of complexities in there, but, yeah, it's a challenge.
Thank you very much. Now, just in closing, just a couple of issues. Firstly, don't forget that this book is available down the back, and I would suggest that you buy it because the insights that it gives into the what we've introduced tonight will give you a remarkable exposure to the really pertinent issues that we need to be thinking about in Australia, whether it be regardless of sovereignty, Indigenous rights, certainly issues around mining, certainly issues around climate change. So you can get a copy of the book down back. The other thing I would do, I'd want to give a shout out for SEED. I really think that sometimes people say, what can we do for, you know, to advance this cause for Indigenous people. SEED Mob are remarkable in the way that they're working within Indigenous communities across Australia, the educative role that they're providing, the link-up that they're providing between Indigenous activists and non-Indigenous activists. They run on the smell of an oily rag and they do remarkable work. I would suggest if you want to see what can be done, just go online, look up SEED Mob, Google them, look at their website, look at the work that they do, and if you feel moved, I would suggest that you make a financial donation so they can continue to do their great work. I want to thank Karina, I want to thank John, I want to thank Eve, and I want to thank Daniel, who hasn't even raised a sweat with what he's been doing here tonight. Please thank them very much for the conversation.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.